Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Valerie Arkush, president of the National Physician Alliance. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare tells us about a device being designed to help regulate inflammation. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
Global maternal death rates have declined since 1990. However, each year across the globe, more than 3 million newborns die and 360,000 women die in childbirth as well, often from preventable causes. A year ago, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced the launch of Mobile Alliance for Maternal Action, or MAMA, founded along with the United Nations Foundation and the mHealth Alliance, linking the vastly expanding mobile communications network with healthcare workers and expectant mothers in impoverished areas of the world. While many women in these regions don't always have direct access to healthcare, more than 1 billion women in low and middle income countries own a mobile phone. MAMA's premise was simple: alert expectant mothers with weekly phone messages that remind them of nutritional and other health advice during their pregnancy, and weekly well-baby advice for moms and newborns. The challenge, according to Global Partnership Director Christian Gagné, fine-tuning the message so they work with the cultural guidelines of each community.
We have a whole set of materials. Our most in-depth right now is these adaptable messages, and basically they are messages that cover the 42 weeks of pregnancy and the first year of a child's life, and there are multiple messages for each week.
Mothers will receive either text messages or voice messages sent directly to their phones, reminding them of the basic things, like bringing newborns in for vaccinations.
The baby is due to have some more immunizations this week, like the ones he had at 3 months. These immunizations.
And community health workers are kept in the loop as well. The MAMA program is already being scaled up in Bangladesh, India, and South Africa, and is looking to expand to 22 countries within the next couple of years, using ubiquitous mobile phone technology to reach isolated expectant mothers, yielding a better outcome for maternal and infant health. Now that's a bright idea. Today we're speaking with Dr. Valerie Arkush, president of the National Physicians Alliance, an organization founded to restore trust in the medical profession by eliminating conflicts of interest. Approximately 20,000 member physicians are urged to refuse accepting monetary compensation from corporate interest in healthcare. The National Physician Alliance is dedicated to universal, affordable healthcare for all citizens. Dr. Arkush is a professor of anesthesiology and obstetrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Now, the National Physician Alliance is sort of a relatively new organization founded in 2005 with a goal of restoring trust to the medical community, which you say has eroded significantly in years due to the influence of pharmaceutical and biomedical companies. Can you paint that picture for us of just how far-reaching is this practice and how deeply has it impacted the medical profession?
Well, it's a very far-reaching practice, and I'm sure that all of your listeners can think about the last time they went to their doctor's office and what they saw sitting on the table, sometimes on light switches, the pen that the doctor was using. Many, many times, all the pads of paper are branded with various drug company names or various drugs. The extent of this is enormous. I have some data from 2008 where it was found that the pharmaceutical industry spent $20 billion, with a B, $20 billion that year on all of these marketing efforts to physicians. And the reason this is so critical is that any gift, even a pen, creates a sense of indebtedness on the part of the recipient. And so the goal with these gifts is very simply to get doctors to prescribe the newer, more expensive, no generic equivalent type of drugs. And for the patient, that may be exactly the drug that they need, but it also may be a drug that is not necessary, and they could do just as fine with a drug that's less expensive and that we have more experience with in terms of safety.
Dr. Arkush, in response to this issue, the National Physicians Alliance has developed the Unbranded Doctor Program, which urges the physicians to renounce the gifts and the lecture fees and marketing of educational events that can undermine objectivity and integrity. And even the New England Journal of Medicine has called this or has lauded the program as unmasking a serious problem. So the problem sounds pretty pervasive, and I understand you've been holding Unbranded Doctor National Grand Rounds in which you share methods for confronting the issue, which helps people avoid the conflict of interest in medical practices and even in medical schools. Tell us about how these Grand Rounds have been going. What's the response, and what do you hope they will accomplish?
The most important impact of the Grand Rounds is to actually educate physicians. Most physicians would tell you that they are not influenced by these pharmaceutical gifts or pharmaceutical-funded continuing medical education programs, and yet there is an enormous amount of data that finds just the opposite, that doctors actually are influenced by this marketing, and it would be hard to believe that the pharmaceutical industry would spend $20 billion a year marketing these things to doctors if they weren't influenced. And so really, step number one is education. And we're rolling out over the next 3 years a series of 12 of these grand rounds. And we're doing this in partnership with Pew Charitable Trusts, Community Catalyst, and the American Medical Student Association in an effort to reach medical students as well as the public.
You know, we recently had Daniel Wolfson from the American Board of Internal Medicine on the show. Talking about the Choosing Wisely campaign, which urges medical disciplines and patients to reduce the number of unnecessary and expensive tests they order. Now, that program is based really on a National Physician Alliance Good Stewardship Project, which brought together clinicians from a number of specialties to assess areas where finite health resources were being wasted, often at no benefit to the patient. So have you been able to assess the impact of the Choosing Wisely campaign is having on the medical and patient community?
Well, what I am sensing is a lot of optimism. The National Physicians Alliance Project went public about a year ago, and we published three lists of five things. We call them our top five lists. One was in internal medicine, one in family medicine, and one in pediatrics, of tests or procedures that have no evidence that they provide any benefit to patients, and in fact can even cause harm to patients. For instance, giving a child antibiotics for an ear infection on the first day of the ear infection. That can often cause problems down the road. So it's things like that that are on the list. And it was very, very well received. That study or that work was actually funded by the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation. And because that was so well received, it has morphed into this much bigger project called Choosing Wisely. I recently attended a meeting called Avoiding Avoidable Care with about 100 other physicians, and it's really fantastic to see what's going on around this work. Physicians are eager, I think, to embrace evidence-based guidelines that show clearly improved quality of care for their patients. And I think very importantly, Consumers Union has been working with the groups to help educate the public so that the public understands why a doctor might be saying no to them. You know, it's sort of hard for a doctor to say no when a patient's asking for something. And I think that doctors feel bolstered by the fact that all of their specialty organizations are now saying, you know what? It's okay to say no to these things because there's just no evidence that they work. So I'm very excited about it, and I think most of my colleagues are as well.
Well, Dr. Arkush, I think we share your optimism on that and also the realization we're up against several decades of tradition, and traditions die hard. And we wonder, as we all look at the issue of cost containment, what other initiatives are you planning? What else is in the pipeline that you see is achieving this aim of both improving care and quality, but also controlling costs and eliminating waste?
Well, in addition to all the top five work, we are, of course, as we discussed earlier, very invested in reducing the influence of drug company marketing on clinical decision making, as well as a medical device marketing on clinical decision making. And kind of hand in glove with that is support for the new Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which people call PCORI. This institute will help fund research that will provide unbiased assessments or comparisons between different drugs, different medical procedures, different devices, And we're very optimistic about that work. And as that work starts to roll out, we'll certainly do our best to help disseminate that to our members so that doctors have more unbiased information about drugs and devices. A lot of the information that we have right now is actually from studies that are funded by the pharmaceutical company making the drug or the device company making the drug, and obviously they have a pretty big stake in the outcome. So we're glad that there's now going to be an independent body doing some of that work. And then another, two other very important areas. One is prevention. And what we're seeing under the Affordable Care Act is a tremendous focus on making sure that patients get proven preventive treatments to keep them healthy in the first place so that we turn ourselves into truly more of a health care system rather than our current sick care system where we wait for people to get sick before we do anything. And that, I think, can at least keep people healthier and working and being functioning members of our community for a longer time. And then finally, we've been following very closely the various payment reforms that are also part of the Affordable Care Act. And these payment reforms will start to move us away from our current system where physicians are paid for the quantity of care that they provide. And they will start to move us toward a payment paradigm where we get reimbursed for the quality of care that we provide. And I think right there you'll start to see a change in cost.
We're speaking today with Dr. Valerie Arkush, president of the National Physicians Alliance, seeking to eliminate conflicts of interest in the medical profession by urging physicians to stop taking financial compensation from pharmaceutical and biomedical companies, which can impact the physician's integrity and objectivity. Now, you were just talking about the Affordable Care Act, and as we all know, June will be the month where we hear from the Supreme Court about their decision around the challenge that has been made. Tell us a little bit about your position around the challenge that's been made to the Affordable Care Act, and I think you've laid out quite nicely the value-added benefits that are embedded in the Affordable Care Act, but have you been active in filing a brief to the court on the Affordable Care Act challenge?
Yes, we were actually. We signed on to one of the amicus briefs, and we feel that the law should be upheld in its entirety. The law has a number of provisions that will make health insurance more secure for those that have it and also over time less expensive. And it also reduces discrimination by insurance companies against women and also people with pre-existing conditions. Women have historically been charged higher premiums than men, even when they were beyond childbearing years. And very importantly and very popular is that insurance companies now must cover pre-existing conditions in children and would also have to do so in adults in January of 2014. So I think what's important and what's been kind of lost in the argument around this is that the individual mandate, which is the provision that says everyone in the country must take personal responsibility and have health insurance, is important in order to have coverage of pre-existing conditions. And the reason that is so is that if a person knew that if they got sick tomorrow and they were having a heart attack, they could call the insurance company from the ambulance on the way to the hospital and get health insurance and be covered for the heart attack that they were having. A lot of people would just simply not buy health insurance when they were healthy. They would wait until they got sick because they know they would be covered. And under that scenario, very few healthy people would probably own insurance. And so the way that insurance works is that we have a large group of people, a small percentage of whom are sick and actually using the insurance, and they're being covered by all the healthy people who aren't. And then when a different person gets sick, there'll be other healthy people to cover them. So if we're going to ask health insurance companies, or demand actually, that they cover pre-existing conditions, really just about everybody has to be in the insurance pool in order for that to work. There's certainly been a number of judges on both sides, both conservative, historically conservative judges, as well as more liberal judges that have found it to be constitutional. So we'll see what the Supreme Court says.
So Dr. Arkush, let me ask you this. Certainly one of the central missions of the National Physician Alliance is returning the practice of medicine to its foundations and service and integrity and advocacy with the patient as the center of care, not business. And we think of that as patient-centered care, which I honestly, I'm not so sure how far we've really drifted from that. Certainly our medical communities have always been concerned about patients. But I'd be curious about your organizing approach to this work. You have a national organization and you've done some remarkable work nationally, but ultimately this is really done on the ground and locally organized in communities where physicians physicians organized. How are you doing that? How are you working at the local level across the country?
Well, I think one of the most important differences about the National Physicians Alliance is that we're not a typical trade association. We're actually a 501c3 charitable organization. And as part of our mission, when we think about issue areas that we're going to take on, we start by saying, how is this going to affect patients? And historically, most trade associations tend to look at an issue and ask the question, how will this affect doctors? And we work, as you said, mostly on national issues, but we are very open to issues that bubble up locally. And we encourage our physicians to become civically engaged in their communities to work on those issues. We also work a lot with other non-physician coalition partners. And we do that in lots of different ways. A lot of it's around producing educational materials. For instance, we just produced a wonderful brochure with the National Women's Law Center about all the new benefits for women under the Affordable Care Act. We've worked with other organizations to help get the Affordable Care Act passed. So it really depends on what the issue is, but we love working with organizations on the ground in different states or cities on issues that people care about locally. I'm really looking forward to the day when, if we have a patient sent to us from another hospital, for instance, maybe in the middle of the night, we can access their records at their other hospital. I do obstetrics mostly. I'm an anesthesiologist that works on the labor floor, and if a pregnant woman calls 911, the ambulance by law here has to take her to the closest hospital that does obstetrics. And so we have to repeat everything. You know, even though that patient's had all of her prenatal care, we have to repeat all of her blood work and ultrasound and all those things, so we just can't access those records in the middle of the night.
It's a big challenge. How do you think they're going to be able to step up to the plate and begin to take on some of this work without bias from the industries?
Well, I think what we're going to see, and we've already seen this starting to happen a little bit, is since the development of electronic medical records, organizations that are historically not sites of research, like some of these large multi-specialty group practices, for instance, that may have a couple hundred physicians, they are going to be able to use those electronic medical records very effectively to look at the patients that they are actually caring for and seeing how various treatment algorithms work in their patients. That sort of basic science work and some of that testing of very new drugs before they're FDA approved and things like that, that will probably still stay in the academic health centers where that work's been historically done. But what we'll see out in some of these bigger group practices is this work on what I would call more outcomes research or health services research, where they're able to take their own large groups of patients and look at how various treatment options work.
You know, I want to ask a question about the pharmaceutical and biomedical companies. I'm now going to date myself and remember back to my days working in divestment in South Africa and thinking about the principles, whether they were the Sullivan principles or the 2-2 principles that we ask companies to embrace. Have you laid out for the pharmaceutical and biomedical companies a set of principles that they should all act by that aligns with the NPA's philosophy? And if so, could you talk to us about its development?
You know, we haven't really done that as an organization, partly because there's a couple of documents that already exist that we have endorsed. The Association of Academic Medical Centers has a set of documents about the relationship between an academic health center and pharmaceutical industries or device companies that we endorse. And the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation has a document called the Physician Charter. And one of the components of that talks about transparency and integrity in practice and the importance of making sure that we physicians take responsibility for careful use of finite resources. And so we've really filled what we think was a different hole, which was to help doctors understand how important these issues are. And so we urge our members and really all physicians not to let the drug rep come in with lunch. You know, there really is no free lunch. Mm-hmm. And not to accept the pens and the pads of paper, and to be very, very thoughtful and careful about going to a continuing medical education conference that's sponsored by a pharmaceutical or a device company. Because oftentimes the information that's presented at a conference like that may not be free of bias.
Dr. Arkush, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
The innovations that I'm really excited about are those that are going to help doctors and patients sort of recapture that most fundamental component of healing, which is simply time to talk to each other. And I think that as we see some of the various reforms rolling into place here, doctors are going to be able to reconfigure their practices so that they can spend more time with the patients that they need to spend time with and use other means to interface with patients that just need a quick lab result or just have a very quick question that another member of the team can answer. And I'm really excited about that.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Valerie Arkush, president of the National Physicians Alliance, an organization dedicated to providing quality, affordable health care for all and restoring integrity to the medical profession by removing corporate conflicts of interest. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
I'm Mariano here with this tech report. Inflammation is the culprit in many diseases and is the process that usually leads to mortality in cases where a patient has had sepsis, a rampant inflammatory response to infection after injury, surgery, or illness that can lead to a shutdown of organs. It's the 10th leading cause of death in this country. A team led by Dr. Yoram Vodovots of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine figured there had to be a better, more individualized way to control inflammation, which is a necessary function the body uses to heal.
You cannot heal from an injury, you cannot fight an infection properly without a properly regulated inflammatory response. So simply eliminating inflammation as a treatment for something isn't the right strategy.
Currently, the primary mode of treatment for inflammation is steroids, which don't always work efficaciously in all patients and can lead to harmful side effects. Dr. Vodovot's team wanted to develop a device that could deliver isolated inflammation control proteins directly to the blood so that it could aid the body in regulating its own inflammation response.
How can I regulate inflammation so that I get just the right amount of inflammation on an individualized basis?
So they developed a device in which a little genetically engineered factory of inflammation proteins are mixed with the blood as it passes through, essentially arming the body to regulate its own inflammation thermostat. Initial tests were extremely promising in lab animals, so they're already on to the next generation.
Which would be, I think, the true sort of thermostat, which is that this factory would only deliver the anti-inflammatory protein as needed based on the circulating levels of the inflammatory signals in each individual.
So how does it work? It's a small device kept outside the body.
So the blood of the animal is flowing into the device. The device is a factory producing the protein of interest, which is an anti-inflammatory mediator, and then that mediator is on the outflow of the device flowing back into the animal.
Dr. Vodovot says no one has produced anything like this to date, and it has huge implications for everything from being used in the battlefield to reduce inflammatory response after injury and has extremely promising implications for people suffering from the sustained inflammation of conditions like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis. What's unique about the inflammation thermostat is it allows a sort of controlled burn, enough inflammation needed for healing, but not so much inflammation that it gets out of control. Because the device is external, Dr. Vodovot sees a faster route to human trials with what could be a powerful new weapon in healing. I'm Mariano Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.